This is the Knowledge Bandits Podcast, and I'm your host, Arun Galadima. Let's start the show. This is the Knowledge Bandits Podcast, and I'm excited to bring you today's guest, Mr. Rotimi Williams. He is a former journalist, and now he owns the second largest commercial rice farm in Nigeria by land size. Rotimi, I've given a very brief introduction, sort of a cliffhanger. People are wondering rice farming, starting from journalism, but can you take the time to let the bandits get to know you a little bit better?
Thank you very much. Yes, I started as a journalist at Euromoney magazine, and then I covered Africa basically for Euromoney. And you know, part of the things we had to do was travel. We traveled a lot. We covered Rwanda, Uganda, Kenya, Zambia, South Africa, and in all of the visits to this country, the one thing you realize very quickly is that the economy is pushed on agriculture. Well, then you come back home to Nigeria and everyone's still talking about oil and gas, you know, and that was a big worry for me. I knew that at some point we also need to go back to basics, which is agriculture, which is more sustainable. And especially with the high levels of unemployment, it was a no-brainer. Mm. You know, so that's sort of what informed that decision. But the journey itself was not as straightforward. So that was it really.
Interesting. And when did you start?
So I moved back. I left England in 2008. I worked in the banking sector here in Nigeria for 2 years. I was put on the oil and gas desk, even though I wanted to work on the agri desk, but they had not developed it then. So I left and I started consulting. Well, first tried to raise a fund, which failed woefully because we couldn't raise anything. We didn't have the seed funding. So I went into consulting for small farms who were looking for funding to expand, either to start to either greenfield or brownfield. So either they wanted to start or they wanted to expand. Mm. And that's sort of how I got a mandate to then raise funds for a farm in Nasarawa. I think it was about $130 million, which I'd never done before, by the way. It was just a leap of faith that, if anyone can do it, I'm sure I can do it. And yeah, I did. I raised the funds in England, which was to be guaranteed by NERSOL here in Nigeria by the central bank. But due to some technicalities, being allowed to write on paper whether it was a guarantee or not, everything collapsed, and then we couldn't get the money. So as part of compensation for the cost of my running costs for during that period for trying to get the funds, you know, I asked the owner if we could 50-50 the farm. And that was a joke, by the way. And he was agreed. The guy just said, oh, yeah, why not? And that was it. And at that point, the farm was 17,296 hectares. And I immediately ramped it up to 55,000 hectares because I knew that once people knew that we were on this project, you know, there'd be a lot of land grabbing. Our expansion plans may be hampered. So I think the smartest thing to do at that point was to ramp up the land. And that's sort of how this journey started.
Interesting. Wow, there's a lot going on there. But you talked about your journey back to Nigeria. Can you talk a little bit about your background before then? What did you study? Where are you coming from?
Okay. So I did secondary school. It was in Nigeria. Here in Nigeria, I went to King's College. And then went to College of Aberdeen. That's just college, and then University of Aberdeen for my bachelor's. I did my master's there as well. I studied economics. My undergrad was economics as well, economic science. And then I did another postgraduate at the School of Oriental and African Studies, University of London, where I studied finance and development studies. And that's pretty much it. Then did a series of short jobs. I worked with the European Economics and Financial Center for a bit before I left for Euromoney.
Interesting. And so how did you get into journalism from there? Most people would probably go straight into investment banking or something like that. How did you get into journalism?
Here's the thing, right? My dream was actually investment banking. But I went for a series of things. Oh my God, I did one interview in England. I did about six interviews with one particular bank. And I was just meeting different teams and different teams. But the fifth one, I thought I was in. And then that was it. And, you know, for me, that was, I just say, you know what? This is it. I will not die if I don't become an investment banker. It's been my dream. But if I don't do it, it's not the end of the world. And then I settled for Euromoney magazine because I got to cover the finance sector. You know, I was traveling to all these foreign countries. I mean, it sounded exciting. You go to all these exotic places, talking to the ministers of finance, talking to leading CEOs of major corporations. You're talking to, at some point, you're talking to ministers as well. So, I mean, for me, it's just, it's exciting. And that sort of opened me up to a high, that, you know, you get, you're a lot more confident, that high level conversation with people like that at such a young age. You know, for me, I mean, there was nothing better that could have happened to me in my life. So, I mean, moving back and talking to people here and trying to convince them that agriculture was the way to go, I haven't seen it in other places, what was relatively easy.
Interesting. And so I'm assuming that, I guess with the new administration, one of the things was pushing more agriculture. Has that had an effect and a positive effect on your business with Karasuk Rice Farm?
Karasuk Rice Farms. Right. Okay, so I mean, I think it was also a thing of timing because at the point where I sort of started my journey, Nigeria was also at the point where they realized that they needed to diversify their portfolio away from oil and gas, right? And if you look at rice is the most consumed product in Nigeria. And on that scale, it's also the least produced product in Nigeria. We have an import bill of about $6 billion annually, right, of which about $2 billion of that is rice. Do you understand? So it was a no-brainer for me that rice was the way to go, at least. Let's see if we can tap a bit of that income. But the journey, I mean, I must add that the journey is not also as smooth as a lot of people believe it is, because the one thing about agriculture is the only thing in your control is putting the seed in the ground. Everything else is not in your control. I mean, the element, you have the weather, you have everything else that is not in your control. So, yeah, so it's been a journey and a half.
Interesting. And so were you, before you started in this, were you at all familiar with farming, with the process that needed to happen to plant rice? Or was it a crash course right when you started?
Definitely not that familiar with what? No. I mean, I think I'll put this down to my experience at Euromoney and at university, whereby if you were asked a question, if you didn't know, it was never a case of you didn't know, you just go research, right? And from there on, I realized how quickly I could pick things up, right? So rice farming for me, I mean, every professor, Every agronomist, every renowned agronomist has an article on Google. So I kind of felt that that was the best place to start. So I want to know more about this particular crop. Go on Google, find out how it grows, find out the conditions under which it grows, find out the diseases that affect it, find out technicality, you know, everything to know about rice. Basically, watch YouTube videos. And that was it. And then we went on, we started with about 50 hectares, and then we just grew on. As we grew, we made less mistakes as we went on. So for me, I don't think it was a challenge at all in terms of not having studied agriculture. Might have been like I did, but it didn't make a difference that I did not. And then you could also hire hands that have that academic knowledge. Maybe not the experience, but they know the things from the book. But if you know anything about this country, most people have gone to university, but they don't have the practical knowledge, you know, of that product itself.
And so do you guys hire primarily Nigerians, or are you sort of diversifying the pool and getting people outside of Nigeria?
Okay, so my model was quite different. I did not want to do mechanized farming. We have a problem with unemployment here. And in any case, most of these people in that area are used to farming. So it only made sense to utilize the existing labor there, right? And for sustainable agriculture, any sustainable project in Nigeria and the rural area, you needed to be able to employ the people. Do you understand? So for me, using external experts did not come on at all. We did not bring anybody in. It was just me, a local agronomist from a neighboring state, and then the local people that went on and did the job, got the job done. So it wasn't, we didn't have to do that. It's rice. It's a basic crop. Like, we complicate agriculture so much. It's a basic crop. You get the seed, you put it in the ground, you give it the necessary nutrients, you watch it, it grows, you know, and then you just sort of learn what to do with it. And challenges come on, you know how to tackle them. You don't really need people to teach you that. You can learn that on your own. And that's pretty much what we did until nature came.
And so how many people do you employ?
Okay, so we did, in 2015, that was the largest one we did from when we started. We're done up to 1,000 hectares, and we're talking about 600 people from beginning to end through the farm in terms of employment. So they're all coming at different stages. So from planting, from the land development, from the land clearing, through to the land preparation, through to planting, through to the inputs, applying the fertilizers and the herbicides or pesticides or whatever it may be, to weeding, right, to managing the irrigation pumps. Everything had its own, had people fluid to security. We had security in the farm as well, because we had issues with herdsmen. So we had to hire some of the herdsmen as permanent security to stop the cattle from grazing on our farm. So that, again, that came on as labor. To harvesting, to threshing. To the threshing, I had threshers, which would get the grains off the stalk, but we used human beings just to create more labor as well. And that was it. So everything was pretty much done by hand. Does it have its negative? Does it have its negative side? Yes, it does. But there's also a lot of positive to it.
You know, I really like what you're saying about using the labor that was there, because oftentimes when people start a business, they're looking to cut costs at every corner. But for you, it seems like it was important that you employed people and not just made money from the business. I mean, it's good. You need to make money as a business to survive, but you're sort of weighing that with the social impact that you're having as well. So I think that's a really good model that we're starting to see a lot of younger entrepreneurs employ in their business models.
I mean, part of what we did as well was, I remember, I think this was end of 2015 as well. No, 2016, where we created the Farm Out of Poverty Initiative. No, this was 2015 now. We created the Farm Out of Poverty Initiative. When it was time to harvest, the men we used decided to pay a fast one on us. So they tripled their wages and then took them three times the time to do what they would have done in a day. Right. So obviously that was hitting my profits hard. So one of the security guys that had the Fulani men, I said, okay, we'll bring some of the women from his village to do the job. And they came on and they did the job at half the price and twice as fast. And that was it. And off the back of that, we created what we call the Farm Out of Poverty Initiative, where we have just women. And the plan was to teach them how to grow rice, give them the inputs that they required, which is the seeds, the fertilizer, to plant, teach them how to grow, watch them over two seasons, which is the dry season and the wet season. And at harvest, you buy back from them, you buy your products from them, deduct the cost of the inputs you've given them, split it into two, you take one half and put the other half in the bank for them as savings. So at some point, they will be able to buy their own products themselves and become more independent. Right? And that way, we're also creating products like producers for ourselves, where we weren't relying on just our own core estate. We had people that were also producing, we could buy from, that we have trained. You understand? So that was really how we planned the Farm Out of Poverty Initiative.
Interesting. Yeah. So,
and what that also did for us was, because they're also the wives of the headsmen, it meant that the headsmen were also very careful to ensure that we didn't have any issues with their cattle. Because they were also benefiting from the fact that we were growing rice, and their wives or sisters or feet were also learning and producing. So they were feeling the benefits as well. They were getting wages, they were getting proceeds from products, you see, and skills as well. So yeah, so it was a win-win situation for us.
Yeah. Interesting. I think this sort of just reinforces that idea that when you're doing something that has a community impact, it impacts your business positively, because there are all of these small things on the side that you might not factor in when you're starting the business, but they end up costing you a lot more. But by being involved in the community and helping people, you find that some of those issues, those problems sort of disappear. Yeah. And so, what? Go ahead.
No, you can go ahead.
Okay. So, you've talked a little bit about, I'm hearing like two different business models that you have, but can you, in a nutshell, tell us what your business model is.
Okay, so for agriculture, basically in Nigeria, I mean, we try to identify where the real issue is, right? If you look across the value chain, you have your inputs, you have your production, you have your processing, you have your storage, and then you have your distribution. Mm-hmm. Right. Typically, the government made a mistake by starting from the processing, right? Assuming that we're already producing a lot. In fact, we're not producing enough because of the lack of the inputs. Mm. So we wanted to play in the area of production, whereby we're not having, because if you play in processing, it means that you have to process, bag, and then distribute. And that requires a lot of capital to be able to market your product and compete against bigger brands in the market. So we chose to stay in the production part of the value chain, whereby we're producing and we're selling to all competitors. So we're selling to all the brands who want to buy and process. So we're not really looking, no one's really competing against us. We're just producing and we're selling to whoever wants to buy. And that way, we can now grow organically. So from producing enough to when they're not producers, to then processing our own products, and then naturally introducing our products into the market slowly. So that's sort of our business model. Because we try to do processing, and we realized that we're not quite ready for it. Because the cost at which we were producing and processing was a lot higher than the cost of goods that were being imported into the country. And that obviously is not profitable.
Interesting. So one of the things you talked about is marketing, slowly introducing your product to the market. So how do you market rice? How do you market agricultural products? Because they're probably brands of rice that people are already familiar with, and I mean, people typically buy what they know. So how do you sort of affect change in that market?
Okay, so here's the thing. So what we've been doing is we've been selling to certain brands that are already very well known. And to come into this market at this point and try and compete against those guys is business suicide. You can't do it because they have the funds to temporarily crash prices and you lose out. So the smartest thing, I mean, what we did is basically, look, we're going to sell to these guys. And as we sell to these guys, we're going to carve a niche for ourselves, right? So if these guys are selling in the north, for example, we're going to go to the south and sell, right? If they're producing this type of rice, we're going to look at this type of rice. Maybe we'll start from brown rice, for example. Let's get known for brown rice. So I will sell the normal polished white rice to them, right? Let's carve a niche for ourselves. And then we'll slowly introduce our own version of the white rice into the market. And once that is accepted, we can then push on. So there are different models you can run with. But to come outrightly and outright and then, you know, put your hand in your kitchen and compete with those guys, it's not going to work. It's not going to work. Yeah. And because we sell to them, so the quality is us. We have that quality anyway. You understand? So we can match anything they're putting in the market. And we can always say, look, we sold to these guys. Now we believe that we can deliver to you better. It's that simple, really. But it takes a bit of time to get to that point.
Yeah. And how long is the harvest until you're able to harvest the rice from when you plant it?
Oh, it's 4 months. So it depends on the seed variety you choose. So we use a medium to long cycle, which is 4 months. It's 90 days, but typically you have to leave it on for about another month to dry before you can harvest. Okay. It's 4 months process. The longer varieties, which is 60 days, 120 days. You see, you have 60, 90 days, you have 120 days, right? You have shorter varieties for drought resistant areas. So there are different seeds for different requirements. But the one we typically use and the most popular is for 4 months. And then you do both dry season and the wet season cycles. I mean, you get more yield in the dry season than in the wet season.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking, are all of the resources that you need there? Because I can imagine maybe in the dry season, it takes a lot more water. So is the infrastructure, I guess, good enough to sustain that at a reasonable cost?
No, it's not. Because, I mean, in the wet season, a lot of people rely on rainfall, right? Mm-hmm. but you also cannot predict rainfall. And even if you could predict it, it doesn't mean it's going to come when you need it.
Yeah.
Which means you need to substitute. You must have your irrigation pumps in place.
Mm.
But then your irrigation pumps cannot really be in place in the rain because most of those areas are prone to flooding.
Mm.
Right? So you have that risk. You have that risk. Now, when it comes to infrastructure and availability of product, if you look at Nigeria, it's a unique landscape. All our inputs, so the pesticides, the herbicides are imported. The fertilizers are imported. The seeds, what is required to grow the seeds that you purchase are all imported.
Mm.
Your tractors are imported. Your land clearing equipment are all imported. Your pumps are imported. Even the diesel you require for an oil producing country, even the diesel you require, you know, to power this equipment are all, it's imported. So you're basically hinged on the dollar. So as long as the dollar goes up, right, we suffer because everything we require to grow rice is pegged to that.
Mm.
Do you understand? And you have these companies then importing rice into the country, and it's smuggled in through the borders at a lower cost. You can't compete.
Yeah.
And I'm getting to this point now where I'm also trying to advise the government that, look, maybe we should stop pumping money into rice on a large scale. Allow only the private individuals to do it.
Mm.
Let the country itself focus on crops that have a comparative advantage over, and then do what I call a balance of trade.
Mm.
Right? So you export what you can and you import what you cannot. Do you understand?
Yeah.
And that's it. Up until you get those other things in place, up until you have your fertilizer industry sorted, up until you have your input, your herbicide and pesticide sorted, up until your seed companies are up to par. Do you understand? Up to you have, up until the point where you have good assembly plants and good financing in place for equipment for farmers.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can start talking about being competitive in the rice sector. Other than that, it's not going to happen from a wide, you know, it's not going to happen.
Mm.
Not going to happen.
And so you have this expertise, this domain knowledge that a lot of other people might not have. And you're talking about affecting policy change. How has that been received so far?
Oh, you mean that's the data collection company?
Yeah.
Is that? Yeah. I mean, so we've only done a soft launch. We haven't pushed it out to the market fully. But I mean, for me, it's crazy that in a country this big, right, there's no policy that is based on data.
Mm.
I don't know any policy that they can pull out the data and say, look, this is evidence-based research and this is our conclusion. No, it's all guesswork based on what they see today. And it doesn't quite work like that.
Mm.
You understand? We've been collecting data now for 3 years on food prices. You understand? So we can tell you why certain products are high at certain times of the year. We can tell you the source of the product. We can tell you why the price changed between yesterday and today. And now we're adding weather forecast information. So we want to add historical data on weather patterns from the source of those products and see if there's a positive correlation between them. If there is, then that means that based on the future forecast of the weather, we can predict to a certain degree, right, what direction the price is going to go.
Mm.
Do you understand? Mm. So this is all information that helps both policy, farmers, investors, people that just want to trade, whatever it is, just giving them that ability to make evidence-based decisions.
Mm. Mm. That's really interesting. So I guess when are you planning on launching that?
So I think in the next week, to be honest. I think in the next week. So we have two things. We have a mobile app called Compare the Market, which allows people to just typically compare the food stock they usually buy in the market, daily stock they buy in the market, household, across different markets and see where it's cheaper for them to shop.
Mm.
And when that price is not there, it means it's not available. So you know it's not available in the market.
Mm.
So we have that mobile app out, which is a free download for people. And it's a spin-off of the main company, which is called Prime Agrolytics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which collects both retail and wholesale prices and qualitative and quantitative data on those prices, on those products, just to be able to make those decisions. So basically just run analytics, we analyze that data,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, the people who require that information either subscribe or ask for bespoke reports on whatever it is they require.
Mm. Interesting.
So we're talking about policies, we're talking about looking at things like pineapple, for example. I'm in Lagos State in Nigeria, and the largest exporter of the 75% of the pineapples we get in Lagos comes from a neighboring country, right, which is the Benin Republic.
Mm.
When in fact, the neighboring state to Lagos, which is a state, has the capability to grow that same product on that scale, but doesn't do it. So what I'm saying to them now is, based on this evidence we have, this is your business case. Mm. You have 5% market share you can potentially take from a neighboring country if you focus on this crop. And you have an employment, you have the land. You're also a neighboring state to this country, right? Mm. Which means that, I mean, everything else is the same. All you have to do is replicate their model and supply the market. Mm. So you can create that policy for pineapple in that state based on the information we give you. So that's what we're looking at. How do we shape agriculture based on evidence-based data, evidence on data, basically?
That's interesting. Wow. That's cool. And so another thing, you talked about talking to government officials, talking to people who are those policymakers about improving policies that affect that affect agriculture in Nigeria. When you propose these changes, or when you're talking with people, is it received well, or are you dismissed? Is it difficult? Is there anything happening as a result of your conversations?
When it comes to talking to government here, it's never smooth, right? So what I usually do is at conferences, I mention them when they start there, and they're the first to listen, right? They don't have an option. I mean, you can't really, they won't take it on board. So you sort of need to force it down their necks. So either through conferences, newspaper, some sort of reports, then they start to pick on it. Otherwise, you know, they don't understand what it is you're saying, because they haven't seen such data before, a recommendation. And, you know, because they've come in with a mindset, it's pretty hard to change that. So picture me telling the Nigerian government, it doesn't make sense pumping all this money into rice production because of X, Y, Z. They're going to try and justify it rather than looking into the sense you are actually making. Right? So until you go on stage somewhere and break it down, do you understand? They don't take it on board. I mean, what government is trying to do with the whole ban on rice is because we can't afford it. We don't have the FX to import this product. But the silly thing, and what they don't see, is that for every bank that funds a farm today in Nigeria, is doing exactly the same thing you're trying to avoid, which is money leaving the country. Because for every money that you give a farmer, for every product he buys that is imported, the money has left the country already.
Yeah.
So why do you keep focusing on that? So what, it doesn't live this way, but it lives the other way. Why don't you focus on those things you have that comparative advantage in, and leave the ones you don't, and then do a balance of trade. Bring them in. There's not, we can't all produce everything we need. You know, but it's a hard message to get across.
And so, in general, when you look at Nigeria, there's been this huge push for people to invest in agriculture, but that's very vague. I mean, anyone who knows of agriculture, you know, like you mentioned, there's a specific value chain for rice farming. There's a specific value chain for every product along the way. So, I mean, investing in agriculture is very broad. But for you, would you say that people should get into the production side of things, or where along that value chain do you think most of the attention needs to be focused on in Nigeria?
Okay, I think that decision you can only make when you have, it depends on the size of capital you have first. Secondly, what your availability is, can you go to the farm every day? And lastly, what your risk appetite is. Because every single part of that value chain offers you something very different.
Yeah.
Hanging fruit for me is distribution. I mean, some people can go in and decide that, look, I just want to buy from this guy who processes and distributes to the market and make a little margin. Some people can decide that, you know what, I want to play in processing where I buy it raw, I add a bit of value and sell. Some people can decide that they actually want to go produce, but the most risk lies in production. And it's also the most difficult one, because if you look at my own, for example, I suffer from flood every time. Every time it's rainy season, we're on our knees praying that there's no flood, right? Yeah. This year, from January, we've had issues with herdsmen. You know, there are a lot of killings in the North Central, which is the same place where my farm is. As a result of that, there's been no farming, right? So those are the sort of risks we face as producers, right? But on the processing side, they can buy from other areas that don't have that same crisis and still carry on. Do you see the problem here?
Yeah.
So that's the issue. So it really just depends on your level of your risk appetite, the size of the capital you have, and your availability. Can you go to the farm every day? If you cannot go to the farm every day, please do not get involved in farming, because you will lose money. That's just the setup of the, I'm talking about being conscious specific now. The setup here is such that if you don't visit your farm every day, you will lose that money.
Wow. I think you're just throwing knowledge at us left and right. I'm sure people are definitely taking notes right now.
You got me talking, did you? now you have to shut me up.
Not at all. Not at all. We need this. Okay. We're called the Knowledge Bandits. We're trying to take the information that you have also and use it. One of the things you mentioned early on was this funding that you were able to go out and raise. Was it $100 million or so?
130 million, yeah.
Yeah. So for most entrepreneurs starting out, the biggest issue they face is finding funding. So how were you able to do it? I mean, it sounded relatively easy. I'm sure there were challenges, but...
No. I think you missed my point there. So I was consulting for a firm, for another project, and my mandate was to raise $130 million for that project.
Okay.
Which I did.
Okay.
But because they were unable to access the money, using a requirement so by the bank, by the funding bank in the UK, that deal did not go through. So it was based on that I got into a deal with the owner of the farm who gave the mandate and went in 50-50 with him on the farm until we went our separate ways and I was left with 45,000 hectares. Now, in funding that 45,000 hectares, right, I had to get rid of, you have to first put your own, they call it skin in the game.
Yeah.
I had to get rid of a few assets to sort of start off on a small scale.
Mm-hmm.
And as we grew, luckily enough for me, like I said, Nigeria was looking to get into, scale up the rice production. Mm-hmm. So they came up with this scheme that for people in rice production, mainly processing, as opposed to letting just anybody import rice, will allow those people particularly to import X amount of rice at a favorable rate.
Okay.
And whatever it is that they were able to save or make from that, then they can then use it on their farm to expand their operations, which was what benefited me. Otherwise, I don't know I've been able to do this because the banking rates are ridiculous. They're talking 20, 25, 30%, or almost 30%.
Yeah.
You know, interest rate. The funds that come to Nigeria are not Africa focused funds. They don't understand that in Nigeria here we've neglected agriculture for the last 30 years. So you're hardly going to find a brownfield operation. Most of the farms here are greenfield. They're new. So you're not going to come with requirements asking them for 3 years audited financials. That's not going to happen. You see? So that's why most funds fail here. It doesn't work. So people cannot respond here.
Yeah.
Exactly. So how do you, so people, I mean, the best way for people to do it is that you start small, you get external funding, or, I mean, you happen to grow a crop that's of national focus, which was my luck, which is rice, where the funds available, the intervention funds made available by the government. And then that is fine. Other than that, it's virtually impossible.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
And I mean, we can stay on this topic all day, but I think what people want is they also want to know a bit more about you as an entrepreneur. So what fires you up? What fires you up in the morning? What is your morning routine? And why is that routine
my
important?
My morning routine. Gosh, you put it in the corner. So morning, when I wake up in the morning, the first thing I do, I wake up by 4:35, I go running.
Wow.
So I try to do 10 kilometers every day. And I guess it's just one of those things that, look, if I can do this much, I can break my body, then nothing else can get to me. There's nothing that's impossible. Right, and I don't like to conform to the norm. If people think that you should be a certain way, I like to be the opposite. If people believe that you should go to the office, I work from cafes, for example. I never go to my office. I hate going to the office. I feel like I'm in a box. Right, so there's certain things like that I think just being a non-conformist allows, and being creative allows you to see opportunities that other people don't see. Which was the same thing in rice. It's the same thing in data. Now I just realized that there's a data gap. It's the same thing with the next venture I'm going into. I'm starting a cattle and dairy farm in the entire country. I mean, we have no cattle industry here in Nigeria, for example. In the entire southwest region of Nigeria, there's not one dairy farm. There's not one company producing butter in Nigeria. And we have 200 million people. Do you understand? So it's just opportunities like that. But you need to sort of be on the other side of everybody else to be able to see those opportunities. You see, and that's just really how it is. I spend a lot of my time, if I'm not running or pretending to be working, I think I've just started DJing. Oh my God, who are going to think I'm not serious now? I started DJing. I've learned to ride horses now. I don't think I'll go as far as polo because it looks dangerous. So I think I'll just stick to riding the horses slowly. And that's it, really. I take life easy. I don't believe in hard work. I believe in working smart. I believe that anything you want to do, spend 80% of your time thinking about it and 20% of your time implementing it. What I see here back home, I see a lot of people thinking about a project for 20% and then using the rest, the 80% to implement. And then they wonder why it's gone wrong. It's gone wrong because you didn't think through the entire process of where it could potentially fail and try to fix it before you started. So this is me. That's who I am.
Interesting. Well, I guess you sort of answered that, but I guess I'm going to pry a little bit more. You are running this rice farm. You're planning on breaking into other markets. You talked about the dairy or the cattle farm. How do you have the time? How do you prioritize your time to be able to do all of those different things?
But here's the thing. It's funny. I still think I have too much time. I honestly think I do. Like, sometimes I tap myself like, dude, you're not working. But I think the difference here, everything I do is fun to me. I mean, when I'm on the farm, I go hunting, I go shooting. On the dairy farm, for example, I plan to go horse riding. So it's never really work for me. I make everything I do fun. So for me, the hard work is gone out. It's gone out the window. The thinking process has been done already. Just now the implementation. Then I get the hands that can implement and run it. I'm not a cattle expert, so I'm going to have to bring in the experts for that. Now that one I have to bring in from some other part of the world. I know, because here in Nigeria, we don't have that. I'm just going to oversee what they do, open up the market, and sit behind the scenes and just watch how everything goes. And continue to open the market up for that particular project. Yeah. As opposed to having to do it. I'll be on the farm every day, but I will not necessarily be calling the shots every day because it's not my expertise.
Yeah,
I saw the vision to start it. I'll continue to watch for other opportunities of where we can branch into. Do we do milk? Do we do yogurt? Maybe not, because there are too many foreign brands on the shelf. We don't want to compete, so we stick to butter and mozzarella cheese. Or do we do this? So there are different things you can do, and that's sort of my own job. So I have the fun part. I started. And I watch it grow.
Nice. And earlier on, you mentioned having skin in the game, and that's sort of how you have to start. Eventually, to expand, you need to raise money. So did you raise money for the rice farm and sort of the cattle farm that you're starting?
Okay, so for the rice farm, for example, we've now reached a stage where to expand any further, we need to raise funding, but unfortunately, like I mentioned, we're having issues with this herdsman activity, primarily in the north central region, which is where my farm is. So,
okay, you're in Nasarawa State.
I'm in Nasarawa State, yes. And okay. If you check 2 days ago, there were killings there. The killings across in Benue and Taraba. So that's not a place you want to go at the moment. So that plan is halted, right? I'm working on alternative plans to start growing somewhere else. That's not concrete, so I can't say too much about it yet. Okay. But on the dairy and cattle operation, that is not a joke. That requires loads of funding. When I say loads of funding, we're talking about millions of dollars. And that's because we're not thinking about small scale, but we're thinking more industry wide. We're looking at genetics, we're looking at embryo transfer, we're looking at artificial insemination and things. So it's not just my operation where we're just going to have these things, kill the cows and sell the meat. No, it's how do we organize the entire country's cattle industry? That's what I'm looking at.
That's interesting. I mean, and I'm sure that there are even more problems that will come as a result of that when you're talking about the herdsmen that are already posing a problem to your industry. Imagine essentially taking away, or rather... radicalizing their industry.
I mean, I see that happening, but the luck I have is for the cattle is in the south.
Okay.
Most of those issues are in the north.
So I'm
more closer to the market. So the cattle farm is in Ogun State. The land has been acquired already.
Okay.
There are already a few buildings on it. The equipment, everything is being worked on at the moment from Germany. So that's definitely on the way. So that's fine, you see. I think the challenges will come when the actual cattle arrive, because they're not cattle from here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now we know what I'm playing with.
Yeah. And you've mentioned some of the challenges that you've faced, but I want you to take us to a specific moment where you sort of observed the industry around you. You observed your market and almost gave up. You thought this might all be for naught. Can you take us to that exact moment so we can understand what it was like for you?
That moment is now. That moment is now. If you look at the whole of last year, for example, I had issues on the farm because a certain billionaire thought it was okay to try to take the farmland away from me. Right? For whatever reason, be it competition, be it part of his own expansion plan, I have no idea. So we spent the better part of last year battling that. Now you're about to start this year again. I mean, in 2015 we had the flood, 2016 we had some seed issues, 2017 we had that issue with the billionaire. I'm sure you know who this is, I'm not mentioning him. and now 2018 we're talking about Headsman attack, and you're still there wondering, hang on, this is supposed to be a great plan. Why are all these things happening? You know, but then again, you quickly realize that agriculture is a lifestyle. I mean, not everything comes together at once. It will take a while before you finally get it right. So just we're still on that journey.
Wow. And I mean, we don't want to bask in those low moments. We don't want to bask in those low points. So throughout, I'm sure you've also experienced some of those high points that motivate you to keep going. So can you take us to one of those moments where you sort of look at it as a shining beacon in all of the chaos that's ensued so far?
I think for me, is when I look at the entire industry, when I started rice, for example, there was not one commercial farm I was aware of in the entire country growing rice, right? And when I started and people got to hear the story that, oh, there's this guy who left Lagos to Nasarawa to start growing rice, I think that inspired quite a number of people to look into this sector. And then, you know, I started getting calls for people asking me for directions. Okay, how do I start a farm? How do I do this? How do I do that? And now today you have quite a number of rice farms that have come up, right? And to know that you sort of led that charge is kind of, you get that sense of feeling about that sense of achievement that you've achieved something. And if that's what I get from it, then that's fine. You know, to have the opportunity to lead an industry on the right path for me is great. And it's the same thing I'm trying to do with the data company. It's the same thing I'm trying to do with the cattle industry. You see, I mean, it's just one of those things.
Yeah. Wow. Nice. And I think that's a perfect moment for us to get into the rapid fire round. Are you ready?
Oh, God. Okay, yes, I'm ready.
What would you say was initially stopping you from taking the step to become an entrepreneur?
That's a fear. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I thought you were going to say nothing because I don't sense any fear coming from you.
No, so you have the fear of failure. You have the fear that you're about to give everything else up. I mean, your parents are there watching you, thinking, oh, he has a great job in England. He's come back. He's working in a bank. He has a relatively stable job. I'm going to throw all of it my way. There's still a part of you that says, God, I feel these people are just going to look at me funny. And even now as an entrepreneur, so people see all the glamorous part, but they don't see what you go through daily, you know, the ups and downs, the depressing moments where you sit back and thinking, how do I tweak this? What am I doing? Something's going wrong here. I'm trying to fix it. You know, it's a difficult one. It's a difficult one. It's a difficult one.
Yeah.
It's definitely fear, but I mean, that shouldn't stop you.
I like that. Someone I interviewed said, Jude Abaga, he mentioned, he said, in response to this whole idea of fear, he said, remaining inactive in the face of fear is remaining in the point where you're most vulnerable to danger. He said, because it's fear lets you know that there's danger and you're supposed to act. But if you remain in fear, you're just staying where you're most vulnerable to danger. So I think you have sort of the same mentality that's pushing you forward. As you encounter fear, you know there's something wrong, and you push forward to get through that.
Yeah. Okay. So I'll tell you this, right? So I have this notepad I go around with, and on the very first page is written that I will do everything I can to change, to do my part to change this world and this country, no matter how, no matter how small. And I wrote that that limit, there's no such thing as limit, right? Limit is only where you stop, right? And failure is only when you stop trying. Do you understand? So when people say, what's your limit? There's no limit. There's no such thing as limit. That's the plain honest truth. Your limit is literally where you stop. Other people are going to go past you. So that's your personal limit. And if you don't push yourself, that's it.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing as, it's the same thing as failure. You only fail when you really stop trying. But as long as you continue trying, you haven't failed. That particular trial was a failure, yeah. But you're still on the path of success, because one day you will get it right. So that's sort of what I live by. Like, even this right thing, I mean, never be the biggest thing I've done. I've just been the stepping stone into an industry where you're eventually going to have to do a lot of things for a lot of people to be able to come on board and just smoothing that right for them.
Yeah.
And if that's what it is, then it's what it is.
Nice. And what would you say is your superpower as an entrepreneur?
You can't hold me down. No. So every time you tell me I can't do something, you're in trouble. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. A lot of people didn't think I could go into the bush and grow rice. I did it. A lot of people didn't think that this data thing made sense. I went ahead, I did it. A lot of people didn't think I could. I mean, I'll give you an example, like the painting I paint, right? I bought a painting in Abuja. This was in 2016. And I thought, hang on, I paid loads of money for this thing. Why? I mean, some guy just got paint, brush, and painted this, and I bought it for this amount of money. I can do this. So I bought, I got canvas. I went out the following day, got my canvas, got my paintbrush, got everything. I literally replicated it. And that was it. I never went back. I went to paint on clothes, on shoes, on canvas. Now I'm painting on bottles. Do you understand? So for me, it's really just about exploring. And that's a really exciting part, you know, that there's really, there's much more out there. It's just how are you willing to go far enough to find it? Yeah. That says, yeah.
And on the flip side, what is one quality that you need to improve on most as an entrepreneur?
Procrastination. Oh my God. Yeah. That procrastination. But here's the funny part, right? Here's the funny. As bad as they say procrastinating is, it's also been one of my greatest strengths. Because I realized that the things I linger on for a long time, that seems like I'm procrastinating, actually turn out to be a great decision that I waited. But it wasn't intentional. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
So I didn't wait intentionally. I was really just procrastinating because I didn't feel like doing it at that point in time. But it always works out for the best. That, oh my God, thank God I didn't do this thing. This is what would have happened. I'll give you a perfect example. Last year, I was asked to raise fund. I was asked to approach the Bank of Industry for funding for my farm, which at that point I would have gotten. But I kept procrastinating. Just I did all the documentation, did everything necessary, but I never put the application in. And I really just didn't do it because it just seemed like a lot of work. It took me ages to finish my application because they were asking me questions that I didn't think were necessary, right? And it just took a lot of time, you know? And in January, I was saying, okay, you know what? It's time to put my application in. Then I was watching TV and I realized they killed 73 people in Benue. And guess what? These so-called people launched their attack from my farm.
Wow.
Which meant that there was no way I was going to grow. Which means that if I'd taken that money the year before and I bought in all those equipment and I'd spent it, and I've been repaying money because the bank won't want to know. They're not going to listen to your stories. You're going to have to repay that money. So that sort of thing I said earlier. So procrastination is the quality I need to improve on. But it's not always been a disadvantage. Yeah.
I mean, all the procrastinators, myself included, heard that, and all we heard is, oh, just continue to procrastinate.
this is the same as that, right? This is my own, in my own life. If it happens to you, you cannot sue me. It will not be my problem. So, yeah, procrastination.
And what is one of the best pieces of advice you've received, and who was it from?
Oh my God. So does this have to relate to business or can it be personal life?
Personal.
personal. Okay, fantastic. Gosh. Do I want to go down this route? Okay, yeah, why not? So my mom will always tell me, right from when I was young, avoid partnerships. And if you must do it, don't do it with a friend.
Hmm.
It never made any sense, right? So she always says, avoid partnerships. What if you must do, don't do it with a friend. And back home here, one thing I realized very quickly is the last thing you want to do when it comes to partnership is go into partnership when it comes to agriculture, especially with people that don't necessarily understand the nitty-gritty of agriculture itself, that not everything is in your control. And when things go wrong, you're often blamed for it.
Mm.
Do you understand? And that's caused me quite a bit of pain here as well, because I did partnership with one or two people. I mean, the other person is not particularly in agriculture, but the first one was in agriculture. And, you know, when things looked like they were going good, we were partners. When it was going bad, I owed him money. Mm. You see the flip side?
Mm.
And then that was the end of the friendship. And it's just a case that just lingered on forever.
Mm.
And the business is just because he did not understand the sector. You sign an agreement that says if you pull out within the first year, you lose your money, basically. And the reason that clause is there is because if there's a loss, how do you expect the business to repay you if you pull out within the first year without planting again?
Mm-hmm.
It's common sense. So if a farmer, if you went into that agreement with someone who understood agriculture, it's fine. But with just someone who's a friend who wants to get involved in agriculture, it's a problem.
Mm.
And that's one advice that if I'd taken, I think I would have been better off to do it, to be honest.
Mm. Mm.
So yeah, I mean, it's a bit off key from what we're discussing, but I think is if you're looking at this sector, it's something you must hold closely. You need to be careful who you allow to invest on your farm.
Mm.
You really need to, it could be it could lead to the end of that project.
Yeah. You know, I find that very interesting. Getting older, talking with my parents, you hear your parents say, oh, they turned down this job, they turned down this opportunity that paid a lot more. And you don't really understand how to say no to more money, especially when you're in a place of, I guess, relative poverty comparatively.
Mm-hmm.
But I like what you're saying. I mean, the second part of what you're saying, you're talking about being aware of who you're starting a business with and the sort of partnerships you get into. But a second part of that, you mentioned before, was sort of alluding to this idea that you shouldn't always jump at every opportunity that comes. You need to be more discerning about what comes your way, because sometimes you might take something and it ends up being detrimental in the future.
Certainly. Yeah. See, you won't put it better than I did.
I have the luxury of listening and then just bringing it together.
I'm rephrasing it, but yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head.
Mm. And what is something you're reading right now?
The Alchemist.
What was that?
It's a book called The Alchemist.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a great one.
Okay, so can I tell you something interesting about this whole reading thing?
Yeah.
So I meet a lot of people here that talk about biographies and stuff. I generally hate them.
Mm.
And I hate them for two reasons. One, people will tell you, I say it because I'm proud, and that's not true. Mm. I don't want to read about people's stories. I rather have people read about me. And the reason I say that is I don't want my journey to be influenced by someone else's story.
Mm.
And that's generally it. So I meet a lot of people here who quote people like Steve Jobs. Oh my God, Steve Jobs quit school to do this. Bill Gates did that. I said, you hang on a second. These guys were trust fund babies. They didn't necessarily quit school. They put it on. They deferred it.
Mm.
They had a lot of money to play with at the beginning. And for whatever industry they were going into, it was kind of right. Bill Gates went in when, I mean, the internet and everything was sort of coming up. Mm. Do you understand? Where the school, they had a mainframe computer in the school and things like that. As all your own luck didn't come together quite the same, and you're already comparing your journey to his journey because you read a book. Yes, and a lot of people just seem to read this thing. So I generally run away from biographies, but recently I've come across books like The Original by Adam Grant, which I liked. I read Malcolm Gladwell's, what's it called now? Everybody seems to have read that book.
Which one?
Gosh, I will remember
Goliath. Tipping Point.
No, not Tipping Point. Before that. It's a more popular one.
Okay.
More popular one.
The first one that I read, I'm blanking on the name too now. Yeah.
Yeah, I can see it, but I cannot remember the name. But anyway, everyone reads that one. But that book again was a problem for me. Right, and the reason is this: everything about myself I was reading in that book, and it was uncomfortable. You know, they talk about being a non-conformist. You know, basically someone just telling you about your life. And it's kind of exciting not knowing. So I dumped that book. And now someone's introduced me to The Alchemist. I never finish books because I get bored. And then she gave me, the book that was given to me was one that, it's a cartoon. It's animation.
Okay.
It's an animation novel. So it was interesting. So I could see pictures. Now I'm reading. I'm excited. I'm almost done. Ordinarily, I'd have stopped from like a third of the way. Like, okay, God, it's interesting, but I can't be bothered finishing this book. But The Alchemist definitely is one that I like.
Nice. I guess you're definitely a nonconformist as a former journalist, not finishing your books.
No, I like to say this. My life is fluid. So sort of where it just sort of goes. Sort of goes. A lot of people plan. Planning is good, but it's boring. Yeah.
And what is one internet resource or application that you couldn't live without?
You're getting me in trouble. Okay. Right now it's LinkedIn, by the way. Can it be an app?
Yeah,
LinkedIn. And I only just discovered the strength of LinkedIn because when I was looking for agronomists, all I had to put in was agronomists, and I was pulling up them up from various parts of the world. So anything I'm searching for, and I'm like, now I'm looking for data, what are they called? Data mine, something, whatever they're called.
Okay.
Right? The engineers, the scientists, right? And they're everywhere. And I'm like, wow, in Nigeria, I could never find this skill because it just isn't here yet. And how else would I find it? So I used LinkedIn a lot. I put up posts, people respond, and then you're sure to meet intelligent people of like minds on LinkedIn. Instagram, I'm there quite a bit just to laugh because sometimes you just need that distraction. And yeah, so Instagram and LinkedIn.
Nice.
Typical, to be honest.
Nice. Yeah. And to close out this rapid fire round, do you feel like you've made it yet?
No. No, absolutely not. No. I think I've just sort of figured out where I want to play now is, and how I want to play now is the execution. So this sort of the beginning, this sort of the exciting part of it. Okay, so these things I figured out. Is it gonna work out? I'm not. Just so this is really the point where it starts. I really don't know why people got excited about the right story, by the way, because it was just a story about some guy who did whatever anyone else would have done, which is put a seed in the ground, it grows. And yeah, but it became such a big deal here that it got me a bit uncomfortable. When I say uncomfortable, very uncomfortable. But is there anything special about it? I don't think so. I don't think so. I actually think the data company is much more exciting than growing rice. But I can also see why people like that story, majorly because I did it in a country where people seem to have neglected it. So it was a bit catchy.
Nice. And as we cool down now, you mentioned The Alchemist as a book that you read and really enjoyed, but or that you're reading and you enjoy. But is there one book in particular, other than The Alchemist, that you would recommend that the bandits read?
That the bandits read. I like the original.
Okay.
I think it's by Adam Grant. Is the original nonconformist? Oh my God! Yeah. So it's sort of not too far away. So it's nonconformist. Blah blah blah. But it's called The Original. That's a fantastic book. Well written. It's sort of. Expands a bit more on, so it sort of demystifies Michael Gladwell's book on things like people like what's it called, Bill Gates, and the like that. Look, stop saying this people dropped out. This is what they did. It sort of breaks it down so you realize that you're not very different, and that you can actually do the same. So I like that a lot, and put things into perspective intelligently in a fun way. That's a really good book.
Nice. And one of the things we like to talk about here is mentorship. So can you share if you have any mentors and who they are.
Now you certainly boxed me in a corner. Oh my God.
talk about the value of mentorship.
This is my disclaimer to everyone now. Every time I say this, people take it the wrong way. Please don't take it the wrong way.
Mm.
I do not believe in mentors.
Mm.
Right? Maybe in the sense of the word, maybe because of the way they use it here. I don't believe in that one person who advises you on your journey.
Mm.
Right? Mm. I believe in making your own mistakes, in blaming yourself for any steps you take, and just taking charge of that journey regardless.
Mm.
I think that's a really fun part. And when people have to tell you what to do and how to do it, they take the fun part away from it.
Mm.
And why else would I listen to someone who hasn't exactly walked a mile in my shoes?
Mm.
Do you understand? I've tried this whole mentorship thing, and half the time, what I get from people when they come to me to mentor them is really just to comfort them and tell them that they can do it. Do you understand?
Mm.
That's it. They don't really need me to tell them what to do, how to do it. They figure that out. So I never really believed in mentorship, but I do also believe that some people need to be mentored because not everyone has that strength. Do you understand? Some people need to be guided, you know, their thoughts need to be guided, their steps need to be guided, especially the younger people, then yeah, mentorship may work. So that's just my own view on mentorship.
Hmm.
A lot of people will say I mentor them. I just see myself as them, just giving them advice based on what I've done. And I always ask them to take what they can from it and dump the rest that doesn't apply to them.
Hmm.
I'm actually writing a book now, by the way, which I've been writing for so long.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when you launch that book, we'd definitely love to have you back on Knowledge Bandits talking about it.
No way. So if I ever launch that book. So what the book is more about me, like my journey as an entrepreneur. It's called The Shape of the Shape. So the name is going to be along the lines of Shape of an Entrepreneur.
Mm.
And Shape is like your spiritual gift. H is your health. A is your ability. P is your personality. E is your experience. And the theme is sort of that everything, all of those things have to come together to form who you are and sort of dictate where you are and what you can do.
Mm.
So knowing who you are in order to achieve your potential, your full potential. And I'm using that in my own story to say, look, I'm able to do this because of X, Y, Z. I grew up in this place, in this neighborhood. My best friend was a mechanic. His sister was his sister was a prostitute, but I knew all of them. So I learned about the streets. I learned how to relate with people from a lower class. And that's allowed me to be able to go and find out certain things and being able to relate to them in the rural areas, being able to identify with people out of my social class. So different things, you understand? Different things have to come together for you to be able to achieve your potential. And you need to be able to identify them as you go. So that's sort of what the book is about. But the reason I've stalled is that I find myself talking about myself, which is a bit uncomfortable.
Mm.
So I kind of need to look for another way to write that book, that it's not really me writing it.
Hmm.
I don't know if you understand. I'm talking about myself. It seems like you're blowing your own trumpet or something. It's uncomfortable. So yeah. So that's sort of why I've stopped. But I need to finish that book. It's been on for too long.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think one of the things I'd say is that sometimes people do want to hear about your story from you. They want to understand how you process information. And for me, when I listen to people speak about themselves, it sort of shapes who they are as a person. And it shapes, I think the way a person views themselves is very impactful in the way they relate with others. So that's one of the reasons I like to see that aspect, but it definitely is uncomfortable. I mean, doing this podcast, it's painful. It's nails on a chalkboard every time I have to listen to myself.
I know. If this was the weekend, I'd probably be half drunk talking to you. So I have to talk about myself again. I'm going to need a couple of shots before I get on this podcast. But yeah, it's fine. It's been good.
Nice. And well, so as we're still almost closing down, I mean, you've given great advice, but there's certain people who are listening that are probably skeptical, afraid to take that step into entrepreneurship. They've planned and planned and planned. They have the idea there, but they just aren't bold enough to take that next step. What advice can you offer to some of those people?
I just say take a leap of faith, right? Mm-hmm. And no matter how stupid some ideas may sound, I would tell people there's no such thing as a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's just whether it's delivered or executed at the right time and the right place. Right? So trying to do certain things, now in the UK may seem like a stupid idea because it had been done 30 years ago. Mm. But implementing the same project in a place like Nigeria, for example, is you may even be two years ahead. Do you understand? Mm. So there's never really anything as a bad idea. You just need to look for a way that makes it work.
Mm.
You know, and I say start now rather than later. And as you go, you refine it, it gets better.
Yeah.
So it's worse when you don't start, because in the future you find yourself, you blame yourself. I mean, the project I've looked at, for example, that I wanted to do, that I never did. I always wanted to come back and start a go-karting thing in Nigeria here.
Mm.
And I built the plan, I did everything, came back, and someone already started it.
Mm.
And that was it, but that's because I did not take my chance.
Yeah.
Do you understand? And that was it for me. And if you look at this data one, as well, when I started, they said, oh, there's another company in Nigeria collecting data. Well, I found out that, yes, there really is, but what we do is very different.
Mm.
It's very, very different. Because we both have four wheels, doesn't make us the same brand of car quality. Mm. And that's just really how I see it. So I say, look, whatever it is, no matter how funny it may sound, develop it, push it out, let it fail. Don't fail. Let that idea fail.
Yeah.
You understand? And you'll be shocked. You'll be shocked that at the point where it's failing, something amazing springs up from there, which is actually where you're supposed to be. It's really funny how things work.
Mm.
It's weird.
Mm.
Well, you need to sort of start. You need to start first.
Yeah.
So something may seem like a good idea. You started, it failed, it leads you to something completely different that you never thought of. That's really the one that works. But you never really have gotten there if you didn't start the failed one.
Yeah.
So I always just say, take a leap of faith, cross fingers crossed, and go at it wholeheartedly and believe in it. Don't let anyone tell you can't do it, because they themselves haven't done it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to draw it on. I mean, you said so much right there, but one thing in particular that stood out to me was, you said, let the idea fail. You don't have to fail, but you can let the idea fail. I like that. And as we're about to say goodbye, can you share with us, ways that we can connect with you, whether it's through social media, email, website, all of that?
Okay. So email is, yeah, you can reach me by email. It's r.williams@twheritage.com.
Mm.
That's my email address. Social media, Instagram is quite straightforward. It's written in W. Okay. So it's just my name and W, one word. The website is www.primeagrolytics.com. Mm. That's the one for the data company. For the farmer, like I said again, I'm non-conformist. I don't see why a farmer should have a website. People have given me help for it here, so I'm going to have to develop one.
Mm.
So yeah, so that's that. But you can always reach me Instagram, LinkedIn is Rotimi Williams.
Okay.
My email is there as well. Yeah.
Nice.
So I'm available. Yeah.
Great. And right before we leave with the final question. So you're tasked with building the greatest business the world has ever seen. You can bring on any two people, living or dead. Who would you bring on, and what would you do?
Oh, God. That's a killer question. I could do anything in this world.
Anything.
Wow. That's unfair. That's such a deep question. The greatest business. Oh my God, I can't even think. The greatest business for me will have to be within my sector, because I'm already here.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it'll be feeling like just looking for ways to. Oh my God. What I'm cracking my brain on now is, who do I bring on board? That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Who do you bring on board? So I'll bring a mind like, I like Steve Jobs. Contrary to everything I've said, so the way his mind works. Yeah, he was also a non-conformist, which is why Apple is different from everything else. I'll bring him on board, because I'm sure he'll see the industry differently. No, Steve Jobs, Rotimi Williams. Let me add a bit of a twist to it, and people are going to think I'm crazy for saying this.
Mm.
I'm going to add Kanye West to it.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'm not crazy. I've looked business-wise. I've seen what he's done. He's done with Giuseppe and other brands, and even his own brand. He's also a non-conformist, right? He thinks outside the box, and that's the most important thing, right? Everybody else, everyone wants to do the same thing, and they forget that there's value in being different.
Mm.
And that's why all those people are recognized today. They're all different. They realize that they don't want to be like everybody else. And that's really why, that's really what makes them valuable. So having them on a team to build anything will be outside this world, I think. And they're all, they're both very dedicated. I'm the one who's probably be the most relaxed of the three. So that's fine. So I think I have a great team. The hard worker, the thinker, and the relaxed guy.
Nice. Well, there you have it. The dream team, Rotimi, Steve Jobs, and Kanye West. Well,
yeah. Rotimi, crazy, but true.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure having you on. I've learned a lot specifically about the agriculture sector, the rice processing, the rice value chain, and I'm sure that the bandits have learned a lot from you as well.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
Stay inspired.
Thank you.
Hey, if you're still there, thanks for listening. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button wherever you listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Handle is Knowledge Bandits everywhere. We have closed sessions lined up with some of the entrepreneurs that we've already interviewed. So if you have questions that weren't answered during the show, you'll have a chance to connect with them during these closed sessions. Just go to the Knowledge Bandits website at knowledgebandits.com and sign up for the newsletter on the contact page. If you or someone you know has a business, we'd love to share your story with the Knowledge Bandits community. Just send an email to interview@knowledgebandits.com. If you have a question for me or you want to connect with any of the guests so far, send an email to me personally at arum@knowledgebandits.com.
Stay inspired.